I'm on these perpetual hunts for things, whether it's watches or these bracelets or whatever. And these bracelets are like a perfect example because I love the hunt of this stuff as well. I find a lot of fulfillment and inspiration in searching and then, of course, learning about this stuff. And many times you come up empty-handed, but it's that journey and that process, which I've really learned to love so much.
What's going on, everybody, and welcome to Collector's Gene Radio. This is all about diving into the nuances of collecting and ultimately finding out whether or not our guests have what we like to call the collector's gene. If you have the time, please subscribe and leave a review. It truly helps. Thanks a bunch for listening, and please enjoy today's guest on Collector's Gene Radio. Today, I sat down with Cameron Barr, founder of Craft and Tailored, to discuss watches, cars, and our newest obsession, Native American Link bracelets. Cam's been in the watch game for a bit now, but he's always done it his way. And although watches are what's for sale, Craft and Tailored has their own image and brand that sets them apart because it's not just about that. See, Cam's love for watches is just an extension of his collections, and it all creates this cohesive case study in sticking to what you love. So without further ado, this is Cameron Barr, founder of Craft and Tailored for Collector's Gene Radio. Cam, finally got you on Collector's Gene Radio.
Thanks for having me. I know it's been a minute. Been a long time listener and big fan of the pod. So thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. I appreciate it. So we're of course going to chat about the usual suspects today, right? And Craft and Tailored and your background. But I also want to make sure we briefly talk about our new obsession that we share, which is native jewelry, and we'll save it for the end. So let's start with Craft and Tailored, but a quick step back at what you were doing before you started.
Yeah, I was in the technology business. I worked for what is called a value-added reseller. It's pretty boring, if I can say that, not to take away from it. But essentially, I was working with big systems integrators and helping them build out their infrastructure. And the cool thing about that is it got me really deep into technology and drove an awareness within me about how connected everything is. I mean, everything today has, you know, wireless connectivity and Bluetooth and an IP address. And that was kind of cool because I think today, doing what I do for a living as well as kind of all of my passions, it allows us to connect to people that have, you know, a like mindset or, you know, similar passions. And that's helped us kind of with Craft and Tailored and really expand in our ability to connect with our collectors and people of like mindset pretty much all over the world. So it's really cool.
Super interesting. Have you always been a very detail-oriented person?
Yeah. I mean, even when I was a kid, I remember being very much into the small nuances and details of things. And I think it was one of those things, I don't know really where it came from, but I always remember paying attention to things that maybe the average person or my average peer at the time, you know, wouldn't pay attention to. So I always dug a little bit deeper, and I think I always find myself asking the question of, you know, why? Why did the stitch of that jacket exist or in that way? Or what zipper were they using for this jacket and why? Or why did they use this stone over that stone? Or whatever element it is, you know, I find myself always kind of digging and diving deeper into things. As a kid, I also spent a lot of time reading and kind of going to the library. And then, you know, in my early 20s, I would grab a coffee and hang out at the Barnes and Noble before Amazon, obviously, and just read magazines and books. And, you know, I always kind of had an interest in that. I've always kind of been searching. I'm on this perpetual search for things, I guess you could say. And as soon as I kind of get that box checked for myself, I feel like there's this void and I'm always kind of in that perpetual pursuit.
So you're working in tech and you kind of start to have this journey and love for collecting watches and vintage watches. And what else were you collecting during that time before you decided to start Craft and Tailored?
Yeah, I think what's interesting about my kind of entrance into watches is I've always had kind of a mechanical obsession to certain things, whether it be cars or cameras or, you know, that kind of stuff. I've always had kind of this, you know, wanting to learn more about those things. And the funny thing is, when I was in tech, I was surrounded by, you know, kind of a different crowd of people. I noticed that, you know, in the corporate world, in some cases, you're surrounded by, you know, things that are seemingly luxurious, right? Whether it's cars or clothes or whatever. But I always liked things that were, you know, made of quality and had, I guess, an attention to detail them that in many cases didn't even really have to do with price. So for example, when I had to wear suits, I always wanted things that were custom tailored, or I wanted my own special touches on things, or maybe to find something through a maker that paid attention to the artistry and the craftsmanship and the little details. And I think the interesting thing too about technology is you're kind of banking on the refresh rate of things, right? You have these tech cycles that happen where ultimately the infrastructure or the piece of hardware or whatever is going to become dated and obsolete. And so you were kind of always wanting to learn or stay on the cusp of what was happening, right? And that's ultimately kind of that business. But I also kind of didn't relate to that because I wanted to acquire things for myself, whether it be cars or clothes or you know, natively watches that had a story and kind of yielded more towards the timeless classic kind of elements. And I put a lot of value into that. So when I was in tech and when I kind of first started to make a little bit of money, I wanted things that were craft and quality and in a way, you know, more timeless than just going out and buying the latest and greatest kind of thing just because I could. So that was an element that I couldn't really relate to. And I think watches really possess that at any level, right? I mean, you and I can talk about, you know, crazy piece, unique, you know, watches, but also there's a bunch of kind of more entry level pieces like, you know, Seikos and, or, you know, kind of some of those brands that have elements of uniqueness and craftsmanship. And I always found it interesting that, you know, those things in many cases didn't associate to the actual price of the item, which I thought was really cool because I could find something that nobody else in the room or maybe in the city or the state was going to have on, but also it was kind of unique unto itself. And that's the thing that I really loved about watches is there's so many variants, there's so many details, there's so many ways to get into collecting at any level. It really offered me kind of this open place of adventure. And you know, even today, I think many would consider me to be an expert in the field of horology and also specifically to vintage horology, but I'm still learning things every single day. There's brands that I'm still discovering and finding passion in that I never would have thought that I would have had an interest in.
Yeah, for sure. I feel the same way. I mean, I feel like each day or each week or each month, something pops up on your radar that you didn't necessarily know existed and catches your eye for whatever reason. But it's kind of interesting because I feel like a lot of people that are in your space struggle with finding their identity in terms of matching it to who they are as a person. And I find that that's so opposite with you because knowing you and your style, it's so synonymous with your brand Craft and Tailored that you look at a photo and it just makes sense. Everything down to the way a photo was shot, to the way you guys market it, it's so your style. And was that easy for you to kind of hone in on your own identity and who you are and just say, this is who I am and this is what I think looks good and this makes sense for the brand? Or was it kind of a journey to match that?
I don't know if it necessarily was a journey, but I think it was something that was kind of always there. You know, growing up, I kind of had my own identity in terms of like what I had interest in. And I don't know if I was necessarily easily influenced by the peer group. I, in many cases, always kind of felt like the odd man out in terms of style or the things that I had interest in because either, you know, my peer group didn't understand it or they didn't care or whatever. So I felt kind of alone in a lot of this. And then when I started Craft and Tailored and what we're now, I guess, calling a brand, even if you look at the watches that we have on our website, if you look at the things that I have in my personal collection, a lot of it kind of, I guess, just is me. And, you know, I think that that was just kind of a natural progression of style and taste. And I guess other people like that too, and find inspiration in that. And that's kind of cool too, because I think for me, I'm always finding inspiration in other people and other collectors with, or other designers or whatever. And so to kind of be that for maybe some other people and to help them on their journey is, I think, one of the most rewarding and kind of fulfilling things for me, because I don't know if I think about it as consciously, maybe as one might think. We kind of just do it and kind of put it out there, and people seem to like it, which is cool. But at the end of the day, if nobody liked it, I probably would think it was just as cool or just as interesting for myself. So it's kind of a cool place to be, I would say, over the past few years, especially in being recognized, I guess, as having my own distinctive taste or style. But, you know, even if it wasn't, I'd probably still be doing the same stuff, if that makes sense.
What's the juxtaposition for you of being a collector and a dealer and sourcing all these watches for the site? I mean, you've traveled the world looking at watches and buying watches and selling watches, so you've seen everything. Are the things that you're after for your own collection a little bit different from the things that you put on the site because you've seen so much and you've kind of honed in on what you want? Or is it really tough to source this stuff and put it up for sale?
It's kind of a mix of both. I mean, it's interesting because we have a pretty big social media following, and we've kind of given the you know, I guess the enthusiast more of an inside kind of behind the scenes look at what we do and how we do it. And I think what's interesting about the collection that we have on the website and what's in my personal collection and things like that is, you know, I think you'll notice things that we probably don't have. And in many cases, when we're buying or curating collections or whatever, there's a lot that we don't get involved in. You'll notice that we don't really have that many like two-tone Submariners on the website, and they're not really in our archive. And it's not a watch that I have anything against. It's just not something that I personally have ever found to be interesting to myself. And maybe that's just an aesthetic thing or whatever. But you know, you'll see things on the site and within the collection, and I think the really interesting thing is we really buy not based on the monetary value or the upside potential. We buy and curate what we really love. And I think that that kind of yields to the other part of your question, which is it hard to sell some of these things? It definitely is. There are moments where I'll find something and it's a better example than the one that I have in my own personal collection. Right. Or, you know, you find something and it's such a good one, and you know, it's kind of like Pokemon, you got to catch them all, right? But I think in my later tenure of collecting and sourcing and traveling the world and kind of seeing it all, I think it allows me to be a bit of an anomaly from the perspective of I have seen it all. And it allows me to develop that eye, and it has allowed me to develop that eye for discerning what is good in terms of condition, what is correct in terms of vintage and spec and all that kind of stuff. But I think in my later collecting, you know, I've been collecting now for what seems to be my entire life, whether it was baseball cards or coins or vintage guitars or Levi's or whatever. I think the thing that's interesting is I now value the sentimental kind of connection with some of these things. I'll give you a perfect example of this. Recently, we were over in Hong Kong and Japan buying for our inventory and helping collectors source some things and all that stuff. And I found this really amazing reference 1016. Now, last year, I wore three watches kind of more frequently than others. And one of the watches in that group of three watches that I found myself kind of wearing more often than not was a 1016. Now, the watch that I had found in Hong Kong was basically a better version of what it was that I had. And you know, there's kind of that, I think, collector side of people that is like wanting the best or the example that's at the top of the key. And I could have easily sold the 1016 that I had or still have in my collection and kept that one for myself. But I'm realizing that in some cases, the kind of, I guess, collecting of the story and the adventure and the energy that I put into maybe some of these things sometimes is more valuable than maybe acquiring an example that is of a slightly better condition or whatever. And it was funny because we had this kind of like recap of the watches that we had bought in a single day. And I kind of was like under my breath saying like, oh man, this one's actually better than mine, you know? But the watch that I have in my personal collection, this reference 1016, you know, I've traveled with it. I've kind of spent my time with it. I have like these kind of memories and associations of my own personal life that are now tied to that watch. And so to sell that one, I would kind of be also selling or getting rid of all those tangible experiences and memories and feelings that I have with that piece. So, you know, that was an example of, you know, oh God, this one's so good. I would definitely buy and keep this one for myself. But I think that kind of goes into a lot of the pieces that we buy. We're really buying, you know, what we like and what we have interest in. And it just so happens that, you know, other people share that kind of same vision too.
Yeah, it's kind of hard when there's a story for it to not supersede things like slightly better condition and all that sort of stuff. So that makes sense.
Totally.
We've seen a lot of vintage watches go up in value. And if we just look at the history of watches, most of them have, not most, but a good amount of them have gone up in value and continue to do so. When it comes to collecting, I find it fairly easy to pinpoint current vintage watches that will continue to go up in value, right? Just follow the trends that they already have had already over the last 10, 20, 30 years. But what I find really hard is to try and pinpoint the modern watches that will do this, other than the one-offs, piece unique, ultra rare, super hard to get stuff. I get that. But I feel the same way about a lot of cars too. And I'm curious to get your take on this from an evolutionary standpoint. It seems inevitable, but the more I think about it, the harder it is to understand, is it possible that these everyday production models are going to rise in value over time the same way the vintage stuff has?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's a question that I get asked frequently. And I think it's something that I definitely think about. I think if we really peel back the layers of quote unquote the general horological onion, and I think this kind of also relates to cars or design or whatever, I think what people might not consider or think about is the way that these items or the way that these things were being produced. You know, if we look at Rolex or Patek Philippe or, you know, any of those brands, I think what you see and ultimately what is celebrated in these things that we so covet and want to collect today is the variance of these things, right? So Rolex, you know, for example, in the matte dial range of the GMT produce all these like little different variants. And I don't know, I don't think Rolex was necessarily planning, oh, like this is a Mark One dial, we're going to make this a long E, or oh, this is a Mark Three, we're going to make the lume plots a little bit smaller and push them towards the center of the dial. I don't really think that there was any foresight on their part to say, create those variants to make them ultimately collectible. And I think that in the way that those pieces were being produced at the time, whether it be Cartier or, you know, Audemars Piguet or any of these brands, I think that there was a variance due to kind of the handmade nature and the handmade process behind all of this stuff, which yields these ultimately collectible variants, which we celebrate today. I mean, even look at like tropical dials, for example, right? That was a flaw in the lacquering process of a dial for it to go from, in most cases, black to this caramely brown color. And in often cases, those watches were not celebrated. For example, if you went in today, bought a brand new Submariner, and then in, you know, 5 to 10 years, the dial went brown, you'd probably be pretty pissed if that happened, right? So, you know, now we celebrate that variance because, you know, maybe those dials were switched out or damaged or whatever. So I don't know if today, in the way that things are being produced, if they're ever going to achieve that type of patina. And I don't think that there's as many variants in you know, modern production watches. And I think that's because of the mechanized process in which we see watches being produced today, right? We're leveraging all kinds of technology to create things in the watch world, whether it be Rolex or Audemars Piguet or whatever, that kind of have an element of predictability and uniformity, which I think is the way that the world is today. People want things that aren't going to age and patina and kind of have that new look to them for a really long time. do I see, you know, sub-variants of watches that are modern in terms of their definition that would then become collectible? Yeah, for sure. I think that there's specific pieces out there. But generally speaking, my opinion is that a lot of the modern stuff that we're seeing today won't have the same type of collectibility as the vintage stuff. And I think that really yields to the fact that, you know, these things, whether it be cars or watches or whatever, were being produced in a way that was in many ways much more bespoke and by hand. And that's what allows for those elements of variance and differentiation, which I think makes them, you know, increasingly much more interesting than say something that is going to kind of look the same 25 years from now versus something taking on a life or a patina of its own.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, it's just interesting, you know, X Watch gets released and it's obviously hard to get. And so it already commands a six-figure premium over the list price. And that is something that with a vintage watch would happen over time, over 10, 20, 30 years, right? It would start to gain little by little a premium that is commensurate with time. With modern stuff, you just see it right out the gate, go up these crazy inflated prices, come down a little bit. And I'm just, it'll be really interesting to see what happens in the future here with some of this stuff, if it stays. You know, it's the same thing with the 911, right? Something that already costs six figures out the gate. Over time, how collectible are these modern 911s going to be when they're already commanding a six-figure price?
Yeah, and I think the other thing that is something that I've always had kind of a passion or an affinity towards is these things being, in a way, like more cumbersome and less technically advanced, but finding the joy and the passion and the pleasure in that. Because if you look at, you know, a lot of what the modern automotive market is producing, you know, it's like saying, is a first generation Tesla going to be collectible in 35 years? Well, if you really analyze that, is the technology platform that Tesla or that modern 911 built around, is it going to be even relevant, right? Because I think, you know, with Porsche, for example, they're a great example of, you know, this iconic classic design. If you see a 911 roll down the street, whether it's from the 70s, 80s, 90s, or, you know, current production, you instantly recognize that iconic classic shape. And I love a lot of the modern, you know, Porsche releases. But I think what's kind of interesting is at some point there was a shift to where the technology was ultimately leading the design. And, you know, you look at a lot of these modern 911s, which really run off of a computer, you know, that technology is ultimately going to become obsolete at some point. And that's the interesting thing that I kind of realized in, you know, having spent a lot of time in the technology business, is a dial-up internet connection now relevant or celebrated? No, of course not, because there's, you know, something that's better and faster and more convenient. And I think we're actually seeing that with cars, right? From a collectability perspective, you know, is a 911 from 2024 going to be just as relevant and or collectible in 2050? Well, the question I think is that technology platform that the car is ultimately built around, is that actually going to even be relevant? Is it even still going to work? Is the component that's driving that, is that still going to be in production? And that's what we really don't know. And I kind of see that with timepieces or things that are seemingly more tangible and less artisan or craft in terms of their nature. Are those things still going to be relevant? Because that technology and that convenience, are those things still going to be, you know, working, right? And so that's, I think, the difference. If you look at a classic, you know, Porsche 911 from the 80s or even the 90s, you know, it the technology wasn't a computer. You know, maybe the luxury comfort feature was, a power window or an electronic seat, right? There's an element, I think, in a balance there, especially with watches, even on the modern side, that, you know, is sometimes really there at a certain level, or sometimes it's not. And then these things just kind of fall to the wayside and ultimately end up in the landfill, I think, at some point. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's too early to tell what will or what won't be collectible. And I think also what people really gravitate towards, because if you look at, for example, like the Rolex Zenith, you know, era Daytona, you still have all those variants and all that stuff. But to But to have a, you know, a self-winding automatic chronograph movement, it took Rolex so many years to really kind of invest into that idea and technology. You know, the mechanical manual wound Daytonas, you know, really, you know, were kind of long standing in their product line for a really long time.
A brand you frequently have on the site is Universal Genève. And as anyone who has any interest in this stuff knows, Breitling has recently acquired the assets and is going to start reproducing watches. Do you think that they're going to try and pull on the heartstrings of collectors like you and I and reproduce some one-for-one models, or are they going to try and pull the modern card and start throwing a pull router in a 42 millimeter case?
Yeah, it's something that I thought about. And when the news broke of that, I was actually really excited. Breitling is a brand that I think has done a great job over the past few years of kind of paying homage to their history and heritage while also employing modern watchmaking capabilities, whether it's the components that are used or the use of, say, more modern materials like ceramic or whatever it is, right? Breitling, I think, has done a great job of doing things that properly take care of the history and the more heritage-based elements of the watches while still putting into a package that is modern and, say, more functional for today's needs. I'm hoping that it's something similar. You know, one of the brands that I think has done a really incredible job of this is Tudor. Tudor has done a great job of incorporating some of those vintage elements and some of those iconic, you know, features into a very modern offering. One of my favorite watches that they released was the Black Bay 58, because when I put that watch on my wrist, I get Rolex Big Crown Submariner or Tudor Big Crown Submariner vibes. But it's a watch that, you know, I can knock against a door jam, hop into the ocean with, and not really worry about, right? And so that really checks all the boxes for me, because I get those, you know, heritage elements that I so passionately love, but also there's a sapphire crystal, there's an increased depth rating, right? The gaskets and the crown assembly and on the case are more modern. So I'm hoping that with like Universal Genève, there is a little bit of that kind of modern but yet heritage, you know, kind of vibe with the entire thing. And I think it's a great challenge for Breitling kind of relaunching the brand. And that brand was really ripe for the picking. You know, there's so many iconic models, there's so many artful and tasteful details of these watches that we love so much today. And I think it's going to be really exciting to see what they come out with. And it's such a brand that is favored by the collector. You know, the thing that's really cool about Universal Genève is, you know, at a price point perspective and from a horological kind of perspective at the same time, they were doing things that were really kind of pushing the boundaries of watchmaking at that time, whether it be a dial configuration or a movement. There's so much history there. I think that brand being bought by Breitling is really exciting and really interesting. But, you know, I think there's also risk in that, right? Because if you create something that's too modern and you're creating something that doesn't pay homage to this kind of favored cult classic brand, and it's something totally different, then I think you're going to lose people's interest and there's going to be a lot of flack. But then if you go one for one, you know, reproduction, I think you lose a lot of the interest of, say, the modern watch buyer that maybe is looking for something that's more functional and more modern in its overall feel and format.
Yeah, they're walking a tight rope there. We'll see what happens.
For sure.
All right, let's chat about cars for a second. A common avenue for watch lovers and vice versa. Did cars or watches come first for you?
I think they were kind of at the same time. You know, I always had an interest in cars. I always liked things that were mechanical and had an element of artful design. And I think you definitely see that in the car world, right? You see different variants, you see different little modifications. You can definitely see, you know, kind of the progression of technology in cars. And also there's an element of functionality to them that I really like. Every watch in my collection, for the most part, is a watch that I wear. And that's kind of a deciding factor for me, whether or not I'm going to bring something into the collection or move it out of the collection. Am I wearing this? Is it something that, you know, I can live with? So same thing kind of with cars for me is, does this, you know, create a feeling or a vibe for me that is something that brings me happiness and or functionality, right? And there's some things out there, like from a car perspective, that are just ridiculous. Same thing with watches. But I think for me, it kind of happened more or less at the same time. I think I always kind of had an interest in cars. Maybe I know more about cars now than I did, say, 15 years ago. But I always think that I liked that stuff. And even as a kid, I liked, you know, old Mercedes and, you know, old Cadillacs and that kind of stuff. Things that were just as stylistically important as they were functional.
Porsche is a big passion of yours, as is mine. What do you think it is about that brand that has such a cult following amongst the many other collectors that are in the same circle as you? I find it is one of maybe three brands at most that has this evolutionary collectability and just interest from such a mass amount of people.
Yeah, I think one thing that I've kind of noticed with Porsche in specific is that there's so many different, you know, levels of the Porsche collector. And I really related to that. I think you could be at the top of the key, you could collect every variant, every color, every model, right? You could be that type of collector. But there's also a subset of collectors that have one car, they wrench on it themselves. Maybe it's their only thing that they have. And I really loved that. I love the Porsche community because you see such a variance in the collector base that all share the same passion. And that was something that I felt for me personally was like very welcoming. And the community is very, you know, open to teach people and share and kind of celebrate the differences as it relates to the entire Porsche brand. You know, I love Ferraris and I love Lamborghinis and those cars, but you'll notice that the collector community around those cars is definitely different than the Porsche collector community. And there's an element of difference there that you don't feel with Porsche. So that's the thing that I really love about Porsche. And I think, you know, even though the 911 is a sports car and it has this cult following and there's pricing all across the board, I think there was kind of this element of, hey, this is a sports car that can be obtained by kind of seemingly almost anybody. And I really loved that. So that's why I think Porsche for me is something that is kind of near and dear to my heart. I also just love how simple a 911 is. If you go back to the 70s and then into the 80s and 90s, you kind of see that similar DNA. And when I get into any 911, you know, even some of the water-cooled stuff, like say a 996 or a 997, you kind of like know where everything is. Everything kind of makes sense. And I think like I like that element of familiarity with the Porsche cars in general. There's a difference to them, but there's also a similarity that runs through them. And I think that that's one of the reasons why Porsche for me, you know, out of all the cars and out of all this stuff has resonated so much and why I think I have a passion with it ultimately.
Yeah, they've done a pretty good job of making you always feel at home, no matter which year, era, model you get into.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And I think, again, the collector community around Porsche is so varied, right? I've spent a lot of time at like Rennsport and at Luftekult and with that group of facility to the collector community. And it's really cool. Like you could have the most beat up turd of a 911 and people are still going to celebrate that and kind of share that passion where on the Ferrari side, maybe if you have kind of a beater that's like your daily driver, there might be a hoity-toity kind of snootiness that is associated with that. Don't get me wrong. I love Testarossas and you know, the early 80s Ferraris and have spent some time behind the wheel of some really incredible Ferraris. And they're beautiful. But I would say that generally speaking, the community isn't as it's the Porsche is kind of Porsche just as a whole is kind of like the every man's car. Like you could be a weekend warrior with that car. You could race it. You could have a total piece of crap and still find love and passion in that. And that's the thing that I really associated with.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, especially here in Arizona, there's a ton of Porsche collectors here. And almost everybody that has a vintage 911 also has a modern Porsche that they drive on a daily basis, whether it's a Macan or a Cayenne or whatever it may be. And there's just so few brands that people collect that way. It's so interesting to me.
Yeah, I agree totally.
Does your love for cars and collecting them influence the way you approach collecting vintage watches or vice versa?
Yeah, I think the one common thread there is, am I going to drive it? Am I going to love it? And how does it make me feel? And I think that that's definitely something that's a common thread between car collecting and, you know, my involvement with car stuff as it relates to watches. And I think the other thing too is watches have become a business for me. It's something that I do for a living, but the car side of the thing is purely a passion. I would never get into restoring or selling cars. If I'm restoring something or if I'm moving something out of my collection, it's definitely because I loved it and I had that passion there. It's never, there's no other element there. It's not something that I do professionally. And when I get asked, you know, oh, hey, you know, can you help me find a Porsche or can you sell me this or whatever? I basically just refer it out. I'm like, hey, here's the people that I work with. These guys are great, et cetera, et cetera. You know, go ask them. But I think the common thread between them is, am I driving it? Do I have a feeling with it? And in some cases, like taste and preference changes. And I think that's the beauty of collecting is all of these things yield a perspective that can't really be obtained by any other means outside of owning it and experiencing it. So I think that that's something that I find really inspiring within the communities that surround, you know, watches, cars, whatever, is I think it's something that people kind of understand at that level is you kind of have to feel it, live with it, experience it for yourself to ultimately decide whether that's something that's for you. Or in many cases, you know, my journey with watches has been interesting from the perspective of there's these things that I had to have, I had to own them, I had to acquire them, I had to wear them, and then I get it. And I'm like, man, this really just doesn't suit my life. This doesn't really fit my wrist properly. This really isn't checking all those boxes. Or maybe it's something that leads me to find something else. Like one of the brands I'm really diving heavily into is early Franck Mueller. And there was a watch, it's owned by Mark Cho in Hong Kong, who is a friend and who owns a brand called The Armory. And Mark has this platinum Curvex Centre style early Franck Mueller jump hour. And the first time I saw that watch, I was like, wait a minute, this is a complicated watch. This is a unique layout. And this is a Franck Mueller. Like, you know, you look at Franck Mueller today and you're kind of like, what is this? Is this an Hublot? Is this a Richard Mille? Is this, what's happening here? Okay. I've got this like weird DLC PVD case, or maybe it's like something that's made out of sapphire. It's not something that I really would associate to. So it caused me to kind of really dive into Franck Mueller, but I also saw similarity to Patek and Cartier that I had, you know, kind of brought into my collection. I saw those kind of like common threads, which really forced me to learn more about Franck Mueller and, you know, him starting with Patek Philippe and him kind of being the watchmaker that was dealing with these early Patek complicated watches. And, you know, so I'm really diving deep into his early models because I'm finding so much joy and variance in the movement and in the dial configuration and the case shape and all that kind of stuff. And if you asked me 3 years ago, would I be buying Franck Mueller, I would have been like, what? Who? Why? No. You know?
Yeah, no, it's special stuff for sure. And I think having those problems with watches of getting something and it not being exactly as you hoped is a much better problem to have than doing that with cars.
Well, the funny thing about cars and with watches is that, you know, cars are big things and you need a lot of space to store them. So
right,
that's been kind of the problem with cars is that, you know, I'll find something and then I'm like, oh, you know, you can only really drive one car at a time. You know, where with watches, you can fit 100 watches into a pretty small box and kind of secure them easily. Where with cars, you have to have a lot more space to do that. So I think that that's kind of the fun thing about watches is you can really dive in deep, but you don't need as much real estate to kind of have these things as you would with cars. So I think, you know, for me in specific, I'm sometimes a bit limited just based on the space that I have available for whatever car, and, you know, shuffling them around, where with a watch box, you can kind of pull it out of the safe in the morning and look at your pieces and pick what inspires you for that day and kind of, you know, change it up quickly and easily versus not so much with the cars.
Let's chat about our newest love, which are these Native American Link bracelets that you and I have gone absolutely nuts for.
Okay. So speaking of like being inspired, I saw your bracelet, and I think the first time I saw it, I can't even remember, maybe we were in New York or something, but we were at an event together and I saw that bracelet and I was like, yo, what is that? Right? That is so cool. What's the deal? And I'm one of those guys that if I find interest in something, or if I see somebody wearing something or driving something, I'm not shy about asking, hey, what's the deal? Like, what is that? Right? And I'm inspired by a lot of different people and different things, especially as it pertains to watches and or cars and things like that. But I saw this bracelet on your wrist and I was like, that thing is so cool. You could just tell that it was vintage. You could tell by looking at it that the stones were hand set and that it was like this piece of sterling that was kind of hand hammered. And there was that kind of like handmade feel to it. So you're like, oh, it's this, you know, old Native American bracelet. And then I think for probably like 3 months, I did a deep dive and I really couldn't find anything. And I learned that there was this gentleman kind of in like the 1930s that had set up this kind of like sterling silver gift shop type of jewelry company that would supply like the Route 66 gift shops or hotels with like this Native American inspired jewelry. They call that kind of the Harvey era of sterling silver jewelry. And I love that kind of like American West kind of stuff. I wouldn't say that I'm like a huge deep fan of like Westerns or anything like that. Although there are a few films and stuff that I think are interesting. And I love that element of like adventure. One of the first, you know, books I really read a lot of like Mark Twain and that kind of stuff when I was in my youth. And I loved like, you know, the Huck Finn stuff and that kind of stuff. So I kind of relate to that element of my childhood. And I think it comes in through these like kind of more Western Native American inspired stuff. So I saw your bracelet and went on a deep search for them. And then the thing that I'm learning about these bracelets is they kind of have these unique kind of open link kind of concho type of designs. And typically you'll see them with these kind of stones, which I also kind of relate to the watch world because I love, you know, watches that kind of employ a uniqueness to the dial based on its creation out of stone. So with Rolex or Piaget or whatever, the thing that's great is, you know, you have this watch that is maybe seemingly kind of ordinary, but the uniqueness comes from the material in which the dial is made from. So every single watch typically has its own kind of uniqueness to it. And I thought that that was really cool. So similar to these bracelets, the thing that I've noticed is that, you know, the setting of the stones is a little bit different. The stones that they're using can have different pigmentation and or grain patterns or whatever. Sometimes it's coral, sometimes it's onyx or turquoise. Yours, I think, is made out of like abalone, which I've never seen before outside of yours.
Yeah, it's wild.
So it's like the perfect, you know, recipe for me to like obsess over because each one of these bracelets is slightly different and each of the configurations that I've been able to find is slightly unique unto itself. And so I've kind of done a deep dive into that Harvey era Native American inspired jewelry with rings and belts and, you know, these link bracelets are so cool. And I think the other thing too that's great about these bracelets is, you know, you could probably collect 50 of them if you could find them, but each one is unique. Even though they're kind of similar in format, the way that the stamping on the sterling is done, the style of the stamping, the stones, they're almost all piece unique. So I think that they're really, really cool. And that is 100% an inspiration and an obsession that has come from seeing it on your wrist and the hours I've spent on eBay and, you know, little auction sites and pawn shops and all that kind of stuff trying to find these things has been a bit mind-boggling for sure.
Well, that's kind of the fun part about it, right? Is that one, you could probably find, like you said, 50 of these and not one of them will be the same. And two, they're really hard to find. And three, when you do find them, they're no more than $100 to $200. And so
yeah.
As rare as some of them may be, I'm sure, you know, they could obviously go up and up and up in value depending on what it is. But for the most part, most of them are $100 to $200. And they're so different and so fun. And yeah, you could collect a bunch of them with different stones. And I've seen all sorts of stones in them. And yeah, they're just so interesting. And I don't know why I bought it when I did. I was just starting to really get interest in this stuff. I mean, I grew up around this stuff in Arizona here, so it wasn't unfamiliar to me. But, you know, sometimes you just see something and it just catches your eye.
100%. And that's the other thing that I think is so fun and cool is like, you know, I'm on these perpetual hunts for things, whether it's watches or these bracelets or whatever. And these bracelets are like a perfect example because I love the hunt of this stuff as well. I find a lot of fulfillment and inspiration in searching and then, of course, learning about this stuff. And many times you come up empty-handed, but it's that journey and that process, which I've really learned to love so much. And that, I think, is a part of, you know, the brand ethos and kind of what I stand for with watches. We kind of have this little saying that is kind of in a weird way become our company tagline. It's more than just watches because these specific subjects are in many cases a vehicle to something totally auxiliary. And that's the thing that I love so much. It's that journey, that adventure, and that inspiration that natively kind of comes from developing a passion for something. And you know, these bracelets are a great example of that because they're not, as of right now, not that expensive. And they're still, you can still kind of find them if you look hard enough. And, you know, it's not like chasing down a JPS Paul Newman or something like that, where the price tag of acquisition is crazy. It's just a couple of $100, but I get that same fulfillment and kind of a fix, if you want to call it, to my addiction to finding these things and, you know, celebrating it at not really that expensive of a price point.
You mentioned on an episode of the Blammo podcast with Jeremy Kirkland that collecting is like ice cream. And I love ice cream, so this resonated with me on many levels. But it's the idea that when it comes to collecting, there are all these avenues and flavors to choose from. And you don't necessarily have to like them all, but it's about appreciating them all. And that is kind of what makes you a great collector or a great dealer in something. Why do you feel that some people have such a hard time just appreciating all the things that are within the area that they collect, whether they don't have to like it, but to have such a distaste for something design-wise is one thing, but to appreciate what it is under the surface is the most important part.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, I'm supportive of the collector and the community. And I think we live in a funny time where there's a lot of people that just have an opinion for the sake of having an opinion. And I would say for me, I always appreciate the opinion and in many cases find inspiration in a differing opinion. I think there's these, you know, whether it be like the internet keyboard warrior or the person that just is like heavily opinionated on something, I value the difference in collecting. And like I said, I think I find a commonality to maybe somebody's differing opinion on something. And I can appreciate their opinion and or the variance in that instead of just kind of like hate on it for the sake of hating on it, I guess. And to that point, you know, you might love, say, pistachio chocolate chunk ice cream. And I might just like hate pistachio. But at the end of the day, we both love ice cream. And I think that's the beauty in this is that we both like ice cream and it's something that we're both connecting over. So instead of just faulting somebody for having a different taste, why not celebrate that? And I think that that's a big part of Craft and Tailored and promoting these different things or finding common characters, I guess, you know, I might be a Porsche guy, you might be a Ferrari guy, but we both like cars, right? And we can both appreciate them differently, but also celebrate each other and the passion that we have. And if we really look deep enough, probably inspire each other in some way to develop and kind of perpetuate that passion through each other. And so, yeah, that's kind of how I feel about watches. In some cases, I might not fully dig on something, but the fact that you know, that other collector has a differing opinion and is finding passion in it. That's the thing that I really love and find kind of a comfort in, if that makes sense. And I think to do what I do, if I'm removing myself from the picture and kind of looking at it maybe from an outsider's perspective, it's kind of crazy. I mean, last year I flew 450,000 miles, right? And that's a lot of butt in seat time, right? For watches. It was all for watches, you know, and it's kind of a weird thing too, because, you know, we're in these great places, Hong Kong or Japan or all over Europe or wherever. And I sometimes pinch myself because I'm kind of on like this weird, like work vacation all the time where, you know, I'm in these places experiencing these amazing things. And I'm kind of also doing this as my job, but it's not really a job at the same time. So I think that that's kind of crazy in the sense that if I were to be a person looking at what I'm doing and how I'm doing it, I think people would probably find like that to be a little bit like, in a weird way, like there's some like mania there, you know, like there's an obsession, there's like this kind of craziness to it. And I can't help myself. Like that's really the thing that I've dedicated my life to. And for me, I don't do anything like just a little bit, like, right. You know, I'm not a guy that, you know, partakes in any kind of substance. I don't drink or any of that kind of stuff. And probably for good reason, because if I did, like the wheels of this bus would just be off and I would be just skidding down a hill, you know, cause like, I don't do anything a little bit. If it's like getting into guitar collecting, I go deep. If it's watches, I go deep. If it's, you know, Link turquoise bracelets, I go so freaking deep. Right. And so I think this passion is deep. It's real. And I think, you know, in order to do that, I'm constantly inspired by other people that have a differing opinion or maybe have a passion that is different than mine and really embrace the difference in that and kind of support it versus just say, oh yeah, that's crap because I don't personally like that myself. And I think that that's kind of a weird element of the world that we're in where there's like a lot of non-embracing of variance or something that isn't boxable. If you can't put it in the box or if you can't explain it in like a black and white way, then it's in some cases unacceptable. And I think you see a lot of that with the watch world.
For sure. All right, Cam, let's wrap it up here with the collector's gene rundown. You know the drill. You can answer these based on any of the items that you collect. Sound good?
Totally.
All right. What's the one that got away?
Okay. So it's actually the first vintage Rolex that really pulled me into the passion. It was a watch that I had found through like this kind of estate jewelry company. I had kind of been on the cusp of turning into a total watch nerd, was on the internet and just on every forum learning. And so I told the guy at the shop, I said, hey, next time, you know, whatever vintage Rolex comes in the door, just call me. I want to buy it. It doesn't matter what the model is. I just let me know. And it was a 1967 Meters First Submariner that had been put into a drawer for years and years. The bezel had come off. So that's probably why it was put into the drawer. And then through time, like the crown came off. And so basically it was like the head of the watch, crystal, no bezel, no crown. And so I bought that watch many, many years ago for even at the time, like no money at all. I paid, I think like $750 for a Meters First 5.5.3. And I had to kind of like, in a way, restore this watch. I had to find the right bezel insert. I had to learn about what mark variant was correct for the serial range. I had to find the correct crown. I had to find a watchmaker to service the movement to get it running again. And that's really what like pulled me in. There was a point in my career when I started doing this professionally in which I didn't value that watch because I had at the time, I think like 8 or 9 5.5.13s, right? And I had ones in my collection that were far superior in terms of their condition and all that kind of stuff. And so I had sold that watch. I just sold it because I didn't value it. And if I could find that watch today, I would pay like 3x what it would probably be worth because of that watch starting my passion, like pulling me into this thing that now I've dedicated my life to. And I think the lesson in that was learning to value kind of this experience and kind of more of the personal connection to these things versus just trying to one up myself all the time in terms of like finding one that's in maybe slightly better condition or a rare mark variant or whatever. So that's one that you know, was a very valuable lesson for me, but that's definitely the one that got away that I kind of, it was self-inflicted pain, if that makes sense.
It'll make its way back.
I hope so. Yeah.
The on deck circle. So what's next for you in collecting, maybe something you're hunting or something you're after?
I definitely think more Frank Mueller stuff. I'm definitely, you know, trying to buy as many catalogs and books. I'm trying to get into like the stuff from like 1989 into the early part of the 1990s. You see kind of this like deviation from the complicated and kind of more handmade, more heritage kind of inspired pieces into the 2000s. So I definitely think I'm definitely down the early Frank Mueller rabbit hole. I'm really excited to do more stuff with brands. So we've got a couple of collaborations that are coming up where we're working with, you know, seemingly modern watchmakers that have a history and heritage that we're kind of working with them to maybe pay homage and tribute to their past. So I'm looking forward to that. And, you know, I'm doing more stuff in the watch media space. So I'm really excited for Watches and Wonders this year. We're going as like a VIP press kind of element this year. Last year, I just literally showed up and kind of just went on the public days and was just blown away by, you know, the watchmaking scene in Geneva. So I'm really excited about that. And I think also the kind of what's next is to continue sharing our adventures and sharing kind of the inside details of what this life is like. You know, we're going to keep producing this kind of short form and potentially some more long form content, relating to our travels and kind of how we're acquiring these things. And I think through that, there's also an element of education where I can show how we're authenticating this stuff, how we're, you know, discovering it. And I think people seemingly really love that and enjoy that type of content.
Definitely. It's been fun to follow along, especially your trips over in Asia.
Yeah, thanks.
The unobtainable. So maybe this is one that's too expensive in a private museum or collection. It's just complete unobtainium.
Oh man, watch, car, anything?
Anything. You can give me both if you have it.
I think with watches, maybe some of like the early like Patek stuff, like the minute repeaters, perpetual calendars, like those are a watch that I've come to really appreciate as it relates to fine watchmaking with complications. And some of those watches now are just getting to the point of being in a way kind of unobtainium in terms of just their price point. And I think the thing is like, if I look at the acquisition of those watches and obviously being in that field and helping clients acquire those pieces and verifying and validating and inspecting and doing all that stuff, I think if I were to like throw down on a piece like that, there would probably be a ton of other things that I would probably want to buy before that. But who knows? You know, my obsession and my passion for this is kind of ever growing and that kind of stuff. So I would say probably some of that stuff. As it relates to cars, definitely some of like the early Mercedes stuff, more of like the coach built stuff, like the early SLs. I think that those cars are getting to the point of becoming unobtainium, and there's not really many barn finds left in that area. So that kind of stuff. I think some of the early Porsche stuff is kind of getting to the point where the value just supersedes the ability to and drive it and enjoy it. I think there's like this pucker factor that happens where, you know, you're trying to enjoy something, but you're like, oh my God, if I park this next to, you know, this like hoopty Volvo, are they going to ding my door? And am I going to be able to enjoy this while, you know, sipping my coffee at the coffee shop? Or am I going to be like nervous the entire time and not want to enjoy that? So I think that those things are kind of reaching a point for me personally where they could potentially become more unobtainium just based on, you know, price point and or just like the pucker factor, if that makes sense.
Right. Makes sense. The page one rewrite. So if you could collect anything besides watches and cars, money is no object, what would it be?
Oh, I think it would be real estate and art. Mm-hmm. You know, I love mid-century design. I just restored a house in Silver Lake and seeing that process come together and my partner was like very much involved in that process. And seeing that come together was really amazing. But I like these like, you know, kind of physical expressions of art that have an element of functionality. And I think that like real estate is kind of the perfect end all be all example of that, where you're creating something that is artful and there's an architect that has a vision, and maybe that vision and element is a little bit quirky, but there has to be kind of a functionality to that. So I definitely think it would be like, you know, those types of things. And then art, I think, is such an interesting thing to see, you know, somebody like a painter, you know, come up with a masterpiece and take that like physical, you know, kind of idea or that like vision or that mental idea in their head and put that onto a canvas. I definitely think that that's something I could probably go broke doing, is collecting art and doing that.
Pretty
for sure.
Easy, right?
Yeah.
How about the GOAT? Who do you look up to in the collecting world?
There's a gentleman who I think has a really interesting and an eclectic taste that is very tasteful. I think, you know, Ronnie Mondavi, his taste is so interesting. I have this little cushion case Breguet that's in white gold. It's from the 70s. Breguet wasn't producing a lot of watches in that time frame, and Ronnie had one. And whenever he would post it, I would like 100% like the post. I would save it in my saved posts and just kind of go back to that. And I recently found one. I acquired the watch through the Davidoff brothers, and that's definitely a keeper in the collection. But that was inspired by Ronnie, and I think like his collection is really interesting because it's so diverse and it's in a weird way kind of unpredictable. You know, he's not just a rare Patek guy. He's not just a Cartier guy. He's not just a Rolex guy. He kind of has all of those things, and he buys with a passion and a taste. You know, I think Jeff Hess is also a guy that I would consider to be kind of a GOAT dude, and honored to call him a very near and dear friend. I think his passion and his collecting and in the pieces is definitely apparent. And that's something that I've always found very aspirational, because he really cares about what is in the collection. He really cares about the community. And, you know, he's been such an inspiration for a long time. So I would say, you know, Ronnie Mondavi, you know, Jeff Hess, who's now with Sotheby's, Davide Parmigiani. I've gotten to spend some really good time with Davide, and he's also another passionate collector, and his collecting is also just so varied. You know, there isn't one sure specific vein that he hones in on. He has so many things in the collection, and they're all interesting and unique and kind of special, from the simple to the complicated. He's definitely a man that I've looked up to over the past few years for sure.
The hunt or the ownership, which one do you enjoy more?
I think now it's probably the hunt. I would say the reason for me is, you know, you get to a certain level where you have kind of acquired, you've seen it all, especially in my profession. But I think I really enjoy the hunt. And I think the other thing that's cool is, for us, if I find something and I buy it for the Craft and Tailored inventory, I have just as much fun and I receive just as much satisfaction selling that to the next guy. Because once you've kind of acquired these things for yourself, you kind of get to this point where you go, okay, well, what's next? What's next? Right. What's next? And you're kind of trying to like always feed that hungry monkey that is seeming to be, you know, jumping on my back all the time. But I think I find value in a lot of, you know, satisfaction in helping, you know, other guys acquire things for their collections. And also it's fun because in many cases I work with guys to help them, guys and gals. Now we're doing a lot with the lady stuff too, with the acquisition of that stuff and seeing their passion ignite. It kind of like keeps my flame alive. And I think like probably the hunt too, like kind of going back to these cool bracelets that we, you know, share an affinity and passion for. I just love like spending time on the internet, like researching and learning about the history and that kind of stuff. So I definitely say for me now at this stage, it's definitely the hunt more so than the ownership, because with the hunt, I kind of get to live through the eyes of my clients sometimes and share passions with other people who have the same kind of feeling for this stuff as I do.
Most importantly, do you feel that you were born with the collector's gene?
Definitely.
No doubt.
Yeah. Like I had, you know, action figures and that kind of stuff that I didn't take out of the boxes and stuff. And I think, you know, it was fun. Like, for example, like going to the department store or whatever with my mom as a child and spending time in the toy aisle and like flipping through the at the time it was like the G.I. Joe little like action figures and finding the one that I didn't have and then adding that guy to the collection and then kind of laying my collection out at night and going, okay, I've got this one, and flipping the box over and figuring out which one I didn't have. I think, that kind of started from an early age. So I think I've definitely, I was kind of born with that collector's gene for sure. And it's definitely perpetuated into other things throughout my life.
Love it. Cam, thank you so much for joining me today. Always good to catch up with you and love that we are now on a new collecting journey together with these Native bracelets and should be fun to see where that goes.
100%. Thanks for having me. It's been an honor and a pleasure and can't wait to share my latest finds with you.
Appreciate it, man. Take care.
All right.
All right. That does it for this episode. Thank you all for listening to Collector's Gene Radio.